You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Now I've got an interesting little tale to analyse today. What did I miss? Have you ever had any regrets in your life about what you've missed, you know?
Oh, nothing. Not one.
Nothing. Have you ever made lists? Have you ever made lists to make up for what you
missed? Oh, that's a good concept, isn't it?
Well, what does a newly divorced, independent, modern young woman put on her list of things to do to make up for lost time? Holly Brumbaugh's novel, What Did I Miss, is an opportunity to find out. So, Holly, welcome to 3CR.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, the comic potential here seems unlimited, given what's on Michaela's list. The reason for that list and some of the things on that list, what are they?
Oh, okay, you're really testing me. So
I've got the book in front of me.
Yeah, so this is a list of the things that she feels that she missed out on in her 20s because she married young and now she's newly divorced and almost 30. And so she creates this no regrets list. And I've got a few things on there and in no particular order. I'll just tell you a few of them. One is to get a tattoo. Another one is to have a one-night stand. And obviously we have things like travel and, you know, climb the career ladder.
But there's comic potential there. But what's also interesting is a social reality. You mentioned that notion of getting married young, mm-hmm. having to account for the decisions you make in life. So this is an undercurrent going through the book, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. So she married and divorced her high school dud, which I'm starting to learn is actually quite common. I've had a lot of readers contact me and say that I've basically written a book about their life.
But this dud, I mean, we'll get to poor old Warren later.
Good old Warren.
But, you know, he's getting a bit of bad press in all of this. And you do suggest something towards the end of the novel, but we'll get there. But now, you don't know what it's like to be stuck in a relationship with regrets is one of the lines. Mm-hmm. But as you said, one of those things on this list is a one-night stand. And it just happens to be with Beau Shepherd. Now, the sex is good, but wherein lies the comedy here? What happens?
Oh, poor Michaela. So she picks up a random guy at the bar, but as fate would have it, not so random. And he reappears in her life is that a bit of a spoiler? I guess. He appears in her life as the new teacher at her school. And so she thought, oh, I'll never see this guy again. Be great, you know. Just a random hookup. And now suddenly she has to work with him.
It's not so random. Well, we'll get into that in a little bit later. But she's got to then manage her role as a teacher and the Year 10 coordinator with mentoring Beau as well. So there's that which is sort of interfering with this notion of an independent life. But there are also a whole series of other hurdles that have been imposed on her, ostensibly to allow her to experience life. So let's go through some of those. Trish. What's Trish doing?
Oh, Trish is her ex-mother-in-law. And I wanted to stay away from that trope of, you know, where a mother-in-law and daughter-in-law dislike each other. They actually are quite fond of each other. And Trish is so fond of Michaela that she's trying to get her to get back together with her son. She's quite a meddler, that Trish.
So there's one. Quinn. What's Quinn doing?
Quinn is Michaela's auntie. And she has basically said to Michaela, you can have something that Michaela doesn't necessarily want, but her ex-husband desperately does. And there's nothing Michaela would love more than to get back at him for the awful thing he did that ended their marriage. And so she basically bribes Michaela to say, you can have this, but you need to stay single until your 30th birthday because you need to process what's happened and you can't just get sucked up into another man's orbit again. You need to be by yourself for a while.
So two hurdles so far.
Two hurdles,
What's Cece doing? Who's Cece? What's she doing?
Cece's the best friend. Cece's just, she's so lovable. But there is a bit of a weirdness between Michaela and Cece since Cece went on maternity leave. And, you know, they have to find their groove again as friends and, you know, address the elephant in the room.
And but Cece's also encouraging her to live life to the fullest.
Absolutely.
So these all act as impediments to basically Michaela hooking up with Bo. But let's get into the school. I mean, she doesn't want this then advertised at school, but it's very hard to sort of keep it quiet. And schools, I mean, you've obviously been a teacher.
I have. I was a secondary school teacher, so I have drawn some brilliant inspiration from characters and situations there.
Give me the coffee cup, because I can identify with this.
Yes, so we do. We have this communal mug, but as we know, things aren't actually communal in a shared space. People are very territorial about their mugs. And there is Michaela's workplace arch nemesis, Agnes, who seems to rule the roost. And she's, Michaela gets in a bit of hot water over this mug.
Well, it's true. It happens. I mean,
it does.
My background in education, I can identify with that. But what does Michaela, well, Bo takes the mug. He thinks it's a common mug. What does Michaela do?
So to save Bo from having a target on his back, she does take a sip from the mug in front of Agnes so that it looks like Michaela was the one that took the mug. She takes a bullet for him, essentially, which really outs her and her feelings for him.
Well, yeah, she's at one time trying not to advertise the fact that they'd previously hooked up, but then she protects him. But Bo reciprocates. What happens at the swimming carnival?
He does. So there is teacher race that Michaela is determined to win because she's the sports teacher and she has a reputation, you know, to hold on to. And unfortunately, at one stage, it looks like Michaela's team is going to lose against Agnes's team. And Bo steps in, he changes teams, and he wins the race for Michaela.
Yeah, but there's a reason. What's the sort of penalty if they lose the race?
Well, if they lose the race, she has to go on a date with Bo. So now she's obviously in a bit of a pickle, but he does give her an out. He does say, you know, I obviously don't want to force anyone to go on a date with me. That wouldn't be much fun. But she likes to be very sportswoman-like. So.
But at the same time, Bo winning the race gets Michaela out of a situation. You know, it's so very complicated. But the really interesting one is Ebony. So there's Michaela, who is Bo's mentor, ostensibly giving him guidance because his background in the military and such like, he's come in as a new teacher, but hasn't sort of worked out how everything goes. And this is what we get. That girl is a nightmare. He blows air through his lips like a disgruntled horse. Ebony? She's not that bad. You might want to cut her some slack. She's going through some stuff. That's all Michaela will say. It's taken 4 years to build a rapport. She won't break Ebony's trust unless legally bound. We all have stuff going on. That's no excuse for her to sit there like a potato. She's miles behind. I don't understand why everyone acts like her behaviour is acceptable. At least I'm doing something about it. So what pressure does this put on the relationship between Michaela and Bo?
Yes, it does create a bit of tension, but he's, like you said, he's come from a military background. He has this very authoritarian approach to teaching, and he's new to teaching. So even though he is older than Michaela, this is a new profession for him. And so she has to, you know, she's got her back up a little bit about the things that he says and how he approaches it. But then she realizes she has to kind of gently guide him through it.
As well as look after Ebony and all of that. Well, that comes to a head. I sort of use that that phrase lightly. At the school camp. Sorry about that. What happens at the school camp? And
I don't know if we're allowed to talk about that at this time slot.
Well, there are certain. It's nighttime. The thing's going on at the school camp.
What happens at the school camp stays at school camp. And
Ebony has actually seen what happens at the school camp.
Yeah, she does witness a connection between the two teachers that she probably wasn't prepared for.
And what does she do about it?
She actually does step in and takes the blame for something that they had done that would essentially get them fired, because she has a real good connection with Michaela, a teacher that she really respects. Yeah. And so essentially is also taking the heat off Bo as well, someone who previously she had butted heads with.
And so really, Ebony has almost saved the day and yes. resolved the situation. So these are the realities that are going on. So whilst it's all lighthearted, Michaela and Bo were very naughty, very childish, and playing a prank on Agnes and all of these sorts of things. Poor Agnes. doing all of these sorts of things, but it's in this instance Ebony that saves the day, which is intriguing. So there's all of this humour at one level, but that awareness of circumstances at another, and at another, and this is the note on which the novel ends. We can't give away what actually happens, but you actually redeem Woz at the end. How much can we say here? We can't give away. There's the situation. Why did they get divorced? That's never really explained till the end, and we find out. But Woz, what does he reveal about himself?
I think what I wanted to try there was that what we're seeing at the start of the book is, I mean, it's from Michaela's perspective, and she has a broken perspective. So when we're seeing Woz, it's through anger, it's through that sort of rage lens. But obviously, as she changes and evolves and accepts some responsibility for her demise of the relationship, we do see that, you know, Woz does get a redemption arc. They both have to own up to some things that they weren't really willing to. But not just that, they needed to also process some things, and they needed that time apart in order to do that.
And intriguingly, it's Michaela taking responsibility for things that couldn't necessarily have been avoided in the relationship, which gives this novel an intriguing dimension, because on the one level, lighthearted, there are some sexual encounters and hot under the collar type thing. It's flighty with the list, and yet at the same time, that awareness of the social circumstances at play, which you hold in balance during the course of this novel.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to give it some emotional weight. And you know, I think characters are not black and white. We're very grey. We're on a scale, you know, that we sort of slide between. And so with Warren, he wasn't going to just be the villain. He wasn't going to just be the antagonist, the bad guy. He needed some sort of depth to him as well.
Yeah, well, it's easy enough to portray people as bad 100%. Guys and good guys.
Yes.
And yet the reality is something more subtle. And we get back to that marrying young. You make decisions in life. Mm-hmm. There are certain circumstances that occur during a marriage, during life, that nobody is really responsible for. They happen.
They happen.
And so all of this comes to light in What Did I Miss? As we go through that list to see what happens, buying lingerie, getting a tattoo. What Did I Miss is the name of the novel. Holly Brunbar is the author. And it is a HarperCollins release. So, Holly, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Next, I have my guest, who is a pre-record, Toby Schmitz.
Toby Schmitz is an accomplished actor, director and writer for stage and screen. His debut novel is called The Empress Murders. Welcome, Toby.
Lovely to be here, Lisa.
Oh, thank you for meeting us at 3CR. So my first question to you is about transitioning from theatre and screenwriting to novel writing. It's a significant shift. What inspired you to take this leap?
The lockdown, I think. I think that was part of it. When I wrote The Empress Murders as a play, back then titled Empire Terror on the High Seas, it was a fairly ambitious thing. I'd grown tired of trying to woo main stage theatre companies with my fringe plays, which I'd written quite a few of. And they were becoming, less and less interesting to me. I was writing for like four middle-class people on a white couch, like a Williamson play, in order to attract the main stage interest, and no one was. So I sort of let myself blow out and go, what about writing something huge? And I'd been thinking about Victorian Gothic horror on stage and why there wasn't much of it around anymore. Like, I think theatres are a good place to get thrills and chills. And so I wrote this thing set on an ocean liner in the 1920s with a serial killer on board. And it was a sort of a genre mash of starts as maybe even twee Agatha Christie cozy murder mystery, and by the end turns into far more Silence of the Lambs. Oh, get me off.
Yes, it does. That's a great way of describing it. Absolutely. It is a real genre mix. Was this kind of a way of debunking sort of conventional genre restrictions?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that plays do that far more easily than the publishing industry, if you know what I mean. Like, you go to see some theatre, it could be anything. It could be someone covered in feathers, you know, doing Dylan Thomas backwards, and you go, oh, that was some theatre. Yeah. And so it was ambitious. And look, the play eventually went on yet again on the fringe in independent theatre and had a modicum of success. But I think that the main judgment on it was that it's a little ambitious. And so then I put it away and wrote other plays and did a lot in more theatre myself and TV and so on. And then, yeah, when lockdown happened, I thought, if I can't write a novel now, I probably won't. And so for the first time in my life, I wrote a plan.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
Like I bought a little whiteboard from IKEA.
Excellent.
And went this many pages per day. But because I had this sort of plot all ready to go, I went, oh, I'm going to turn that into a novel. And look, if I could go back 5 years, I may have chosen one of my slightly more simple plays to adapt into a novel.
Mm.
But people back in 2012 or whenever I put the play on said, this should be a book, man. So that's what I did. I spent lockdown writing it, and it was sort of a 4 or 5 year process.
I was going to ask you sort of that difference between playwriting and novel writing. Is there a certain freedom that novel writing gives you, in the sense that you can sort of jump into someone's head and then you can become the voice of the ship, which you actually did do? You created the voice of the Empress herself.
Yeah.
So how do you find that in comparison to theatrical
techniques? I think freeing is the word, Lisa. It was freeing. One thing that, I mean, the theatre's freeing to begin with, but then I was kind of like doubled down on freeing when it came to the novel aspect of it. I've read a lot of books. I live and work in my family's bookstore, so I know what one should look like, at least on the cover.
Mm.
I've always been sort of inspired by pretty ambitious narratives about what a novel can be, which is sort of the same question as what is a play?
Yeah.
Do you know, does it go for 15 minutes or 4 hours? Well, it can be either. But I did find it freeing whilst simultaneously learning about convention and so on. Like, the editing process and the writing process was not without its grueling aspects. But another thing that doesn't really happen on stage very much, unless you're as brilliant as Shakespeare, is you don't get into backstory. No one kind of on stage goes, well, when I was born, or my mother, when she was born, whereas like any Dickens or, I don't know, Jonathan Franzen or whatever, is allowed to do that. So I found that very freeing to go sort of retrospectively go back and create backstories for my characters that I felt added to the theme of sort of colonialism and post-colonial guilt, but also to just the sort of the murder mystery aspect of like, oh, this guy doesn't sound that lovely. Once we get into his backstory, maybe he's the killer.
A
freeing.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed your humour in the way that you've written this, particularly with your character descriptions, and in particular, Nicole. Can I quote you here? She says, the narrator says, I guess, when most people scrutinise, they narrow their eyes, whereas Nicole's go huger, as if someone has hit her on the back of the head with a spade. I did actually laugh out loud at that point.
Good.
And And you describe Tony, his hands in his pockets as usual, jostling the family jewels. Where do these character observations come from?
Oh, that's a very good question. Like, I'm first and foremost an actor, and I've been sort of, I don't know, I always loved the idea of a sort of P.G. Woodhouse character, but also a cocaine flapper.
Yeah.
Stuck on a ship.
Yeah.
And a sort of a South African playboy who's not very tall, who is constantly jostling with his private parts in his pockets. Well, I went to school with five of them. I suppose one accumulates these details and then... And then you sort of let them fly.
Yeah.
The extra layer on that is that it was a play, and a lot of my friends were in it. And Nicole's my favourite character. I love writing her, and I love talking about her. But the mother of my daughter played Nicole.
Mm.
So cut to 10 years later, when I was filling them out in a way, in a prose sense. Was that I had these incredible actors and the memory of them doing these performances ready to go. The eyes suddenly shooting wide or whatever. That some of these details weren't in the play, but I was just fortunate enough to be able to sort of raid and plunder the performances of wonderful colleagues and friends.
What a gift.
Totally. Yeah.
So then you can actually really see, as opposed to kind of make up in your head, you know, facial expression and so on. Do you think maybe for every book you can have it as a play first and then...
I would love that. Look, the next one I'm having a crack at is definitely based on a play, but an unproduced one. But maybe that's just... I just think there's a curiosity that applies to all artists. And if you tap into it, you can, as a writer or even as a musician or an actor or a painter, you can draw on that dude you saw on the bus this morning.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It works in many different mediums, I guess.
Yeah.
So the novel offers a critique of the British Empire's excesses and brutalities, if you like, and through this diverse cast of characters and their interactions. It's a sharp commentary on societal hierarchies and injustices of the era. And my question is, I guess, why this era? Is there some connection between modern day and this era, do you think?
Look, I'm in my late 40s. It's a lovely question. And I happen to, I believe, a few people in my generation are just completely affected by World War I, World War II. That's our grandparents and their parents. And the cool swinging 60s Cold War aspect is my parents. But they all seem linked. I was always fascinated by 20th century history. My father taught it. So those books were always there. And there's something about the Holocaust, which in a sense this book is heading towards, is steaming towards, that, you know, I had a history lecturer at uni who said, you should never think about anything else. but I chose to set it in 1925 for a specific reason, sort of the halfway point between the war to end all wars and everyone not thinking that the Holocaust is going to happen, but also maybe as a high water mark for the British Empire. As an Australian growing up in Perth, and then during the 90s, with the Redfern speech and so on, you know, that stuff was always preying on my mind. And maybe the final twist to get me to write the play and then the novel was I wanted to write an Australian story that talked about that stuff, but not set it in an outback farm where some terrible crime happened last generation and a whole lot of monosyllabic men can't communicate with each other. Like, I felt I've seen that.
Mm.
So when I discovered the sort of the blatant metaphor of a luxury ocean liner called the Empress of Australia that was operating during the 1920s, I then felt that I could sort of, I don't know, launch into something that I would enjoy writing and maybe would enjoy seeing or reading. Yeah,
and there's a lot of contradictions in there. Clearly that's something that you pick up on, the contradictions within a movement or a concept that, that makes you laugh, I guess.
Well, yeah, maybe that's a lesson I learned as an actor, is like, you know, every bit of pill needs a spoonful of sugar on
it. Yeah, yeah.
Laughs are very much welcome in any narrative, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I wondered if your personification of the ship, in a certain way, it reminded me a little bit of the book Thief and the personification of death in as well. Are you familiar?
Yeah, I am familiar, and it was played on my mind about what is the narrative, what is the perspective. You know, I'm a huge Martin Amis fan, and a few of his novels always latched into my brain or onto it like barnacles. One of his is Time's Arrow, where the thing is narrated by the soul of a character.
Oh.
Another is a later novel of his, The Pregnant Widow, where the narrator says blatantly, "Try and guess which one of these characters I am," and then it's revealed at the end. I was like, "That's a lovely." It just allows you to play around, and then with this novel, the addition of the ship as an occasional narrator came late in the piece. Pacing about, going, there's something. I want something. You know what I was thinking? I was thinking, I want something feminine for this very sort of butch discussion about wars and colonialism. I just wanted a more feminine, maybe mischievous, but all-knowing voice in there. And it sort of struck me, I don't know, at some point.
Yeah.
I went, what about the ship drops in?
And which is ultimately in charge of the direction of the entire piece.
Yes, and I like it being a bit slippery.
Yeah.
Who's talking now? But of course, you don't want to confuse a reader. But that a lot of the work over 5 years turning into a novel was about... do I know who's telling me this story at the moment? Do I care? Is it okay that it's a bit slippery and scary that I don't know who's talking to me?
Yeah. Well, it certainly kept my attention. And I'd like to thank you, Toby Schmitz, for being my guest today on Published or Not. And the book is called The Empress Murders, and it's published by Allen & Unwin. Thank you.